Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene Fodor.
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Walk away quietly in any direction and taste the freedom of the mountaineer. Camp out among the grasses and the gentians of glacial meadows, in craggy garden nooks full of nature's darlings. Climb the mountains and get their good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their own freshness into you, and the storms their energy, while cares will drop off like autumn leaves. As age comes on, one source of enjoyment after another is closed, but nature's sources never fail.
I know that our bodies were made to thrive only in pure air, and the scenes in which pure air is found.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And those quotes we just read were, of course, from the great John Muir, one of the great priests of the religion of the mountains.
Absolutely. A true American hero. I say that without a shred of irony. An important individual in the natural preservation efforts of the United States. And I like these two quotes because he's getting into the power and the awe of the mountains in that first quote. And in that second, he's talking about the air of the wilderness. And we're going to be discussing the air of the wilderness in this, our second episode on sacred mountains. But I suppose we should of course, refer you back to the first episode. If you didn't listen to the first episode on sacred mountains, go back. That is the important first installment. But let's catch everybody up to speed on what we chatted about last time.
Sure. Well, last time we talked about holy mountains from religious and cultural beliefs around the world and common types of beliefs about holy mountains. We talked about the idea of mountains as the homes of the gods or as the bodies of gods themselves, as like entrances to other worlds, as pillars that hold up the heavens, as places of pilgrimage, as places where the gods once were or still dwell or sleep. There's almost an infinite array of ways in which mountains have been religiously significant. And so we talked about some reasons that might be. Of course, there are things having to do with perspective when one climbs a mountain and looks down at the earth. There's just the sheer fact of its size, I mean, in a pretty basic sense.
Yeah, and just how important natural forms are in our the shaping of our cosmologies and our sense of self. We discussed like the main points along these lines in the last episode.
We also, though, talked about stories expressed by many mountain climbers, though certainly not only by mountain climbers, of hallucinations during the journey of climbing a mountain, including the very common third man syndrome, the experience of sensing another person making a journey with you, who in fact is not there.
Right. And it's very often, I would say, a neutral apparition.
Mm-hmm. Or helpful,
not, if not a beneficial one. So it's not like, oh my goodness, there's a monster beside me. It's more like, oh, well, there's a, I thought I was up here alone climbing this mountain, but there's this other fella. Mm-hmm. And that's comforting to know that it's not just me.
Yeah, we read a section from an account by the mountaineer Frank Smythe, who wrote of his experiences attempting and failing to summit Mount Everest alone in 1933. And he wrote in one section of his account, quote, "All the time that I was climbing alone, I had a strong feeling that I was accompanied by a second person." And then later, "I remember constantly glancing back over my shoulder, and once, when after reaching my highest point, I stopped to try and eat some mint cake, I carefully divided it and turned around with one half in my hand. It was almost a shock to find no one to whom to give it." And of course, there are also plenty of much more recent reports of the same thing. People having strange experiences, delusions, hallucinations, or at least apparently to, you know, modern skeptical thinkers, hallucinations. It's very possible if people had these experiences in the ancient world, or if they're just less skeptically minded, they might think, you know, this was a real presence with me on the mountain. There was something supernatural happening up there.
Right. There was something revolting about my mint cake that drove the spirit away.
Uh-huh. Now, it's clear that very high altitudes can have a number of health effects that could have neurological and psychological implications. These are generally thought to be caused by the lower air pressure at higher altitudes. This is understood to be the major cause, though I think it's worth emphasizing that there are things that are still not fully understood about altitude sickness.
Absolutely. And, you know, there have been numerous studies over the years about individuals who are acclimatized mm-hmm. to a high altitude environments. That's something we could potentially come back and do an entire episode on.
Yeah, but I think one of the interesting things about altitude sickness that we still don't fully understand is why it affects different people so differently. Mm. Like, you can't always predict whether a person will experience altitude sickness at a certain altitude. And so the generally understood major cause of altitude sickness seems to be the lower air pressure. It means less oxygen is compressed in the atmosphere because you're up higher. So there's less atmosphere. You're sitting on the air you're breathing.
Right. And this was an idea that we initially explored in the under pressure episode.
Yes. And so this means you literally get less oxygen with each breath. And of course, you need oxygen to survive. If you're getting less of it with each breath you take, you can begin to suffer negative consequences in the body and the brain.
Right. And meanwhile, you are perhaps climbing a mountain.
Yeah, so you're exerting yourself anyway, but it can happen even without exertion. Mm-hmm. That's important to note. And exactly what altitude it sets in varies a good bit from person to person, like we were just talking about. A reasonable figure at which a significant percent of people will display symptoms is sometimes cited to be 8,000 feet or 2,500 meters. But for each individual person, it's a toss-up. You individually might be affected at a lower altitude or a higher altitude. It's hard to know for sure if you haven't been there before. It's usually said to be worse if you ascend quickly and don't give your body time to adapt to lower air pressure at higher altitude. So that is one thing. If you're expecting to be like hiking at a high altitude, it's good to give yourself time to hang out at high altitude without exerting yourself first.
Always be wary if you're aboard the Starship Enterprise and you teleport down to a mountaintop.
Mm-hmm. Teleport to the lower mountain area first.
Right.
Then, yeah.
Yeah. Base camps are still important, guys.
But some common symptoms of like mild to moderate altitude sickness would be the kinds of things you would – first of all, the kinds of things you would expect with less access to oxygen. So maybe shortness of breath, breathing harder with less physical exertion, faster heart rate. You know, your heart's beating hard. It's trying to oxygenate your tissues. You're just not getting enough oxygen in each breath. And so, you know, you'd expect those kind of things. But also you can experience nausea, dizziness, or lightheadedness, and it can mess with your natural drives such as for sleep and for food. So you can have loss of appetite, headache, and that kind of thing. In much more severe cases of altitude sickness, you can have changes in the color of the skin. You can have tightness in the chest. You can have mental effects like, you know, loss of awareness, loss of coherence or confusion. Mm-hmm. There can even be coughing up of blood or loss of consciousness. And there are subsequent life-threatening conditions that can come out of altitude sickness. One is known as high-altitude pulmonary edema, or HAPE, H-A-P-E, where altitude sickness leads to a buildup of fluid in the lungs. This, if you experience it, is life-threatening and you should act on this immediately. Another is high-altitude cerebral edema, or HACE, when altitude sickness leads to swelling of the brain, which is very dangerous and, of course, can cause all kinds of mental disturbances. And so obviously one question we might have is, if people often report seeing things that aren't there in the mountains, to what extent can these be traced to known psychological – or not psychological, known physiological conditions like cerebral edema, HACE?
Absolutely. And as we mentioned in the last episode, you know, we're not looking at this as like this, the sole cause or the sole reason that one has mountain myths. But it could certainly be a potential thing that augments them or feeds them in some cases.
No, as we mentioned previously in the other episodes, there's no way that, say, psychological disturbances as a result of, you know, less oxygen reaching the mm-hmm. brain or something like that could explain all the myths. One reason for that is that many holy mountains aren't high enough to cause any altitude-related symptoms. I mean, there are holy mountains that are just a few hundred meters high. So it's obvious that, you know, these are geographical landmarks and they serve, you know, they represent things to people. It doesn't have to be that somebody went up on there and had a hallucination that caused them to found a religion or a myth around the mountain, though we do want to point out that it's possible that in higher mountains, people going up into these altitudes could have contributed to beliefs, you know, strange supernatural beliefs about some mountains.
Right, and or the idea that in general mountains provide some sort of loosening of the veil between this world and the next.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So I want to call attention to one recent paper in particular in the journal Psychological Medicine that deals with these phenomena of people high up in the mountains having strange and anomalous experiences. This was by Katarina Hufner et al. Called Isolated Psychosis During Exposure to Very High and Extreme Altitude, Characterization of a New Medical Entity. And this was published in 2018. So the authors here have examined about 83 documented cases among reports from alpine expeditions, and they believe they've identified a new independent condition that's separate from altitude sickness and separate from any existing mental disorder. It's called isolated high-altitude psychosis. Now, of course, psychosis is a set of symptoms including—
That would be IHAP, right?
Wait, what?
We can call that IHAP.
IHAP?
IHAP.
Oh, I didn't even think about an acronym. IHAP. Yeah, this is IHAP.
Okay.
The International House of Psychosis. Yeah. Psychosis is a set of symptoms including, quote, hallucinations, delusions, disorganized speech, abnormal psychomotor behavior and negative symptoms, and additionally impaired cognition, depression, and mania. So it's characteristic of underlying conditions like schizophrenia but can also occur in isolation due to a number of inciting stressors. You know, one of the things is people often think that hallucinations can only occur if somebody has an underlying mental illness, but people who don't have an underlying mental illness sometimes experience hallucinations just depending on like fleeting stresses and things that are affecting them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oliver Sacks' book, Hallucinations, is always a fabulous source on all of this because he, you know, he discusses hallucinogens a little bit in there, but for the most part, it's all these various other causes mm-hmm. that are in play.
Right. So the authors examined a list of documented cases of mountaineering, and they looked for signs of high-altitude psychosis, and then they cross-referenced this to see whether there were always concurrent symptoms of physiological distress from high altitude, such as high-altitude cerebral edema or HACE. Obviously, you can see why if the brain is swelling with fluid, that might cause things like hallucinations and mental disturbances. So from previous studies, we know that how often psychosis occurs at high altitude seems to vary a lot depending on who's doing the counting and what criteria they use. So this is unfortunately a case where the numbers are not very solid. They seem to be all over the place. Like Wu et al. In 2006 found that there were hallucinations in 3% of cases with HACE. Wilson et al. In 2009 reported hallucinations in 32% of climbers above 7,500 meters, which is a totally different criterion than the last thing, obviously. So we're not going apples to apples here. We're just seeing what there is to see about hallucinations at altitude. Brueger et al. In 1999, quote, found hallucinatory experiences in 7 of 8, or 88%, of world-class climbers who reached altitudes above 8,500 meters without supplementary oxygen. Obviously, this is a pretty wild fluctuation, and I don't know for sure, but I'd guess the discrepancy here has to do with the methods they're using to select cases in these different studies, right? You'd probably get very different numbers if you just check to see if climbers self-report psychosis versus, say, proactively asking them if they've had psychosis.
Yeah, this is one of those spreads of numbers that brings to mind the whole, like, you know, it just depends on how you torture the numbers, what kind of story you're going to get out of them, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the problems here is that we don't have anything consistent to work with going into the study. So they had to try to come up with a method of their own. And they know it's not perfect, but it's just to sort of get a rough idea of where to start looking at this problem. So in the present study, the authors found, first of all, that psychosis of some kind often happens when you're at high altitude. Their sample, which they did from consulting existing literature, yielded a result that found, quote, hallucinations occurred in 42%, or 35 out of 83, of the episodes that they surveyed at a mean altitude of 7,280 meters. And of these episodes, 34%, or 12 out of 35, the hallucinations occurred at the same time that there were signs that the person had cerebral edema or HACE. They determined that high-altitude psychosis can happen together with HACE or with other physiological effects or without them. Therefore, they concluded that isolated high-altitude psychosis, or IHAP, your coining, should be considered an independent psychological condition related to high altitude and not just as a possible symptom of altitude sickness. And finally, they concluded that high-altitude psychosis is associated with an increased risk of accidents or near accidents. That's kind of not surprising. Now, they proposed some hypothetical causes for these non-HACE cases of high-altitude psychosis. One would be like social and sensory deprivation in conjunction with psychological stress. Stress is often a common inciting factor for people who don't otherwise have a mental illness to have hallucinations.
Right. And then, of course, it's so varied depending on how much stress an individual is going to have in a given circumstance and then how that stress is affecting their performance and their mental capacity.
Yeah. And then you add social and sensory deprivation to that. They don't have anybody else there to talk to if they're climbing alone or they have limited numbers of people there with them. Their view of the world, you know, there might be a lot less like color and stuff than they'd normally be seeing.
Oh, yes.
Another potential cause they cite is, quote, dysfunction of the temporoparietal junction and angular gyrus due to hypoxia, hypoglycemia, and cold. And then finally, they say, well, another possibility is just that HACE is going on in these cases and somehow it's being underdiagnosed in the field. Maybe a lot of these people experiencing psychosis do have HACE and just for some reason the normal symptoms are not showing up and being recorded.
This is, I mean, especially true if you're going it alone, right? Or even if you have a climbing partner, like you may not, I guess, be having just a regular check-in about your feelings of physical and mental health.
Yeah, and of course, cerebral edema is like that's really dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you have this, you should be getting treated for it. That's not like a time to say, okay, I'll just power through and try to go on up to the summit. Now, this is interesting. Going back to what Frank Smythe and the others have talked about with their experience of what's known as third man syndrome, the authors here found that when climbers reported perceptual disturbances of various kinds, the majority, though not all of them, but the majority of them were either neutral or even helpful and comforting. For example, a hallucinated climbing companion who protects and guides them, or a voice encouraging them or warning them of danger.
Mm.
Now, just because the majority of these perceptual disturbances and hallucinations are positive in nature, or at least neutral, doesn't mean we shouldn't worry about them, since hallucinations at high altitude seem correlated with a risk of accidents. It's not hard to see why that would be. Climbers at high altitude should be aware that psychosis is very possible and should develop defensive strategies for what happens if it sets in. If you think you see somebody that you don't remember being there otherwise, you should have like procedures in place for that, like reality testing.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand about this study, obviously there appears to be some weakness in the selection criteria for cases. But I guess in this kind of study, you're limited by the fact that you can't just stick people, you know, random test subjects at the top of a mountain and see if they undergo psychosis. There also, the authors point out, there is survivor bias at play, right? We're hearing the stories of people who were able to report their stories.
Right. So people who did not succumb on the mountain.
Yeah.
Or experience some sort of a fatal accident.
Or didn't have somebody with them who got to report what happened.
Right.
Yeah. They say for future studies, you could perhaps simulate some conditions like this in chambers that simulate altitude with low oxygen or low atmospheric pressure. Also, you don't need to have a huge or hugely random number of cases if you just want to establish that sometimes people report psychosis at high altitudes with no record of altitude sickness or acute sickness like Hayes.
Now, we mentioned already that one of the other factors here is that not all sacred mountains are enormous skyscraping, monuments to the sky god.
Right. Most sacred mountains are probably not even tall enough for people to be reaching the same kinds of altitudes that are in this study, mm-hmm. though some are. The authors here point out that most of these reports of symptoms reminiscent of psychosis among mountain climbers come from very high and extreme altitudes, so like 35 to 5,500 meters or even above 5,500 meters. So there are going to be tons of holy mountains around the world that do not even reach these altitudes. Nobody could climb high enough to be at the altitudes like the ones being studied in this research. So I'd say whether the physiological or psychological effects of altitude contribute to these types of religious beliefs in some cases, especially at higher peaks, is hard to know for sure. But absolutely, it seems possible and even a tempting origin story for some holy mountains and sacred peaks around the world.
Yeah, one thing, and I may come back to this, the whole idea that most of these reported cases of another, of this, this third man or what have you, is going to be neutral or beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, when we look at all these different myths about holy mountains, so many of them are about like the gods living there.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to find more mountain monsters. I mm-hmm. truly did. I'm always looking for the monsters. And not to say there are not mountain monsters. Certainly there are. There are traditions of things coming down from the mountains, Krampus,
oh, yeah.
et cetera. But it kind of seems like they're weighted in favor of at least the neutral deities, neutral spirits and what have you, and even beneficial beings, as opposed to the monsters of, say, Mount Doom or the Lonely Mountain in Tolkien.
Well, maybe we will explore mountain monsters a little bit today, but maybe mm-hmm. we can explore it more in the future. I'm just now, I didn't think about this when we were preparing, but I just now remembered the mountain trolls of Iceland.
Oh, that's right. All right. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll look at another study and we'll move on to a particular mountain creature that, yes, you might qualify, you might describe as a monster.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, what have we got next, Robert?
All right, so I was looking at a study. This is one that you found, and then I ended up diving into it.
I was interested. I didn't know about this one because it seemed like some of the – well, you describe it, and then we can discuss.
Okay. Yeah, this one was titled, Why Revelations Have Occurred on Mountains, Linking Mystical Experiences and Cognitive Neuroscience. This was published in Medical Hypotheses 2015 from Otterzebeck, Idild, Lansib, and Blankieb. Quote, here's a quote from the piece. Quote, prolonged stay at high altitudes, especially in social deprivation, may also lead to prefrontal lobe dysfunction, such as low resistance to stress and loss of inhibition. Based on these phenomenological, functional, and neural findings, we suggest that exposure to altitudes might contribute to the induction of revelation experiences and might further our understanding of the mountain metaphor in religion.
Oh, okay.
So they're really going for it.
Yeah.
On this one. And they point to the major revelations in the three major monotheistic religions.
Mm-hmm.
In Judaism, the burning bush. This is where God speaks through the burning bush. This is from Exodus. Christianity, there's the transfiguration from the book of Matthew. This is in which Jesus's divine nature is revealed to onlookers.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Islam, there's also the point where Allah speaks to the prophet Muhammad. And that is also like a mountain revelation. Now, one of the problems here is getting into the idea of insufficient altitudes, right?
Yeah. So I'd seen this study brought up on a science blog somewhere, and I thought it was interesting because it's touching on this question we're asking, but I saw it in the context of it being ridiculed because the main mountains that it's talking about aren't really that high.
Right.
You know, so they're not like super high mountains that would be likely to cause altitude sickness, right?
Right. Yeah. They're not dealing with Himalayan peaks here, right? This is what the paper says, though, about the idea of moderate altitudes. They said, although the revelations discussed here had occurred in moderate altitudes, it may be assumed that in subjects who are prone to mystical experiences, already moderate altitudes are sufficient to trigger revelation-like experiences and revelations. So I guess the argument here then, I guess, is first of all, you know, not everyone's going to have the same reaction to high altitude like we've discussed.
Right.
And that even moderate high altitude, they're arguing, could be sufficient. Potentially, this is one of those more research needed areas,
right?
But it could be enough to push people's minds toward mystical experiences, especially if those minds are already susceptible to, say, hallucination, to voices, or to the experience of the supernatural, and then the remembrance of supernatural experience, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that they focus on like the Abrahamic monotheistic religions,
yeah.
Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, because in the last episode, you remember, we had a discussion about how it seems to me that that actually sacred geography plays less of a role in the Abrahamic religions than it does in many other religions around
right.
the world, whereas In the Abrahamic religions, it seems that when a place is holy, it's usually because the idea that something important happened there.
Right.
Whereas in many other religions around the world, the place itself has some religious significance. The land itself, the mountain, is the home of the gods, or is the body of a god, or is sacred in its own right, not just because of something that happened there.
Right. I imagine there could be – this is room for a lot of theological discussion in each of these three religions. But all three of these, even as we were mentioning them, we were mentioning the event. They were mentioning in the paper the event that took place,
mm-hmm.
the meeting of an individual and the divine, for instance, in the case of the Jewish and Islamic examples. So at this point, I want to turn to a particular mountain entity because I think it lines up with some of what we were just discussing here. And that entity is the Yeti in the Himalayas.
Everybody's favorite cooler.
No, not the cooler. I mean, unless the cooler has an actual Yeti in it.
Oh, that'd be a good trick if they ever discovered one. What was it? Wasn't there somebody in Georgia who claimed they had a Bigfoot in like a beer cooler? No, it was like a freezer, right?
Yeah, it was a whole thing about 10 or 11 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember it well because for one fleeting second, it made me wonder, are we about to know that there is a Sasquatch? And of course, that turned out to not be the case.
It was like a costume or something.
Right. Now, the Yeti. In modern Western culture, it has become just kind of a Himalayan variant of the Sasquatch. You know, if I say Yeti, you may just picture a Bigfoot or skunk ape, whatever the regional variation of this creature is. And I do think that is important as we're moving forward to think about the fact that there are variations of the wild man being in various cultures.
Basically and, like a bipedal creature covered in hair that is seen all around the world but has distinct origins in each case, right?
Right, yes. I was looking – I wanted to get a little like a better snapshot of this ape-like beast as far as like Himalayan traditions go. So I ran across a very insightful piece titled Bhutanese Tales of the Yeti by Kunzang Kodun, Tales of the Creature Exist Through the Himalayan Region. And the author points to the different names that are given to this entity.
Hmm.
So in Tibet, there's Gangs Mi or Glacier Man. There's Mi Shan Po or Strong Man and Mi Chin Po or Great Man. The Sherpas call it Yeti. The Lepchas call it Chu Mung or Snow Goblin. I like that one.
Mm.
Or Hlo Mung or Mountain Goblin. In Nepal, there's Nyalmu or Ban Manchi. He didn't provide a translation for those, but I'm assuming some treatment on these various ideas, you know. And then the Bhutanese say Migoy or Strong Man or also Gredpo. So, you know, we get this idea of some like figure of of savage, cold strength with possible, goblin-y qualities as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Choden writes that the Migoi idea here, it dates back to the pre-Buddhist Bon writings. This is the pre-Buddhist animist religion. I believe we mentioned this briefly in the last episode.
Yeah, the indigenous religion of Tibet. It came up because Mount Kailash or Mount Kailasa in the Himalayas is a peak that is holy not just to Hindus who believe, some of whom believe that Lord Shiva and Parvati dwell on top of Mount Kailash, but it's also holy to some Buddhists, Jains, and members of the Bon religion, the Tibetan mm-hmm. indigenous religion.
And apparently some Bon rituals call for the blood of a Migoi slain with a sharp weapon.
Whoa.
Yeah. So this was a pre-existing idea, but then you get some Westerners involved, right? Mm. And then you get this idea exported and reignited in the Western mind. So British traveler William Hugh Knight of the Royal Society's Club recorded a Yeti sighting in 1903 on his way back to India from Tibet. And then there was another sighting in 1825 by a Westerner, by a Greek zoologist N.A. Tombazi. Who described it like this. Unquestionably, the figure in outline was exactly like a human being, walking upright and stopping occasionally to uproot or pull at some dwarf rhododendron bushes. It showed up dark against the snow and, as far as I could make out, wore no clothes. And then later you had print sightings and so forth in the 1950s that helped popularize the idea of the Yeti in the West.
Mm.
Various films, television series like In Search Of helped to contribute to this idea. And today the interest in the Yeti continues, but there remains no proof that the creature exists. In fact, examination of preserved evidence of Yetis tends to lean toward the intentional or accidental misinterpretation of another animal or its handiwork.
Hmm.
So DNA work from the past few years, for instance, points directly to at Asian bears as the source of the samples. So in all of this, and any time we're talking about a Yeti sighting, even in like the Himalayan region, you know, we can't discount hoaxes and various other reasons. But when we consider the potential effects of hypoxia and these other like high-altitude situations.
Yeah, which all I think in some degree are related to hypoxia.
Yeah. You know, we might be talking more of a full-blown hallucination. And then at lower altitudes, the effect could just be enough to make the individual, you know, see what they want to see when they glimpse a normal animal or another human being.
Hmm.
So I found this idea. First of all, I did see this idea echoed in Searching for the Yeti, Mysterious Monsters, a 2014 book by Jennifer Rivkin. Now, this is a kid's book. I want to be clear about this. So normally we don't cite a lot of kids' book, but this one was actually, I was reading through it. It's pretty good. It seems to balance the sort of mystical what if with a lot of legitimate skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I did see this idea echoed in a couple of journals and books, such as 1989's High Altitude Medical Science by Yuda Kushma and Vogel. And I think there is a lot of, you know, there are a lot of similarities between, for instance, that Yeti account that I read earlier mm-hmm. and accounts of a third man, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like here, there was some other creature there and, you know, it wasn't human, but it was hanging out. It was there. I glimpsed it. And then once you have this, and this is of course on top of a pre-existing idea of there being some sort of a Yeti creature in the mountains. And then once this idea becomes a part of Western culture as well, then there's more room to misinterpret the evidence or even your senses.
Now I wonder if like a psychological thing, kind of like the climbing companion, the third man syndrome, is going on here. What do you think it might be that would cause people to see a bipedal human-like creature covered in hair as opposed to seeing, you know, another human dressed like them, or to seeing like a dead relative or something, you know, one of these common hallucinations of comforting figures?
Well, on the hair thing, I think certainly if one glimpsed a bear, that could throw you off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you've ever seen a bear in the flesh, you know, it can be this weird, surreal, and frightening experience. I mean, hopefully a little frightening because as far as I'm concerned, if you encounter a bear and you don't have like a certain amount of fear, you're doing it wrong.
Oh, I think there are good reasons why we see bears as objects of prehistoric religions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's quite clear that bear worship in various forms goes back a long way. That's one of those where it's kind of obvious why that would happen. You know, it's this kind of like, to many people, the bear would clearly seem to be like the king of nature.
Yeah, this beast that can also rise up on two legs and stand like us, that is seemingly slow and lethargic, but then full of energy and ferocity. Mm-hmm. That also, we got into this in our Winter People episode a couple of years back, a creature that in some cases digs its own grave and seems to die and then reemerge with life in the spring.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem quite mystical. You can totally see why a bear would be a thing that you would be, you know, afraid to speak its name, speak its dangerous holy name, and why if you saw one out in the wild, yeah, you might think you'd had some kind of otherworldly encounter.
All right. Well, on that note, let's leave the Yeti and take one more break. And when we come back, we'll continue to discuss the topic.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Sue. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed, and to expand your thoughts. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back. Now, we've been discussing records of delusions, hallucinations, and other just various strange sightings and encounters that seem to occur often at high altitude, some possible explanations for what might be going on physiologically, neurologically, psychologically there. But we're going to continue with this now.
Yeah. So real quick, a couple of other just examples of not mountain climbers, but individuals encountering some sort of phantom stranger. Well, there was a case of Sir Ernest Shackleton. He encountered such an apparition. Also, Antarctic explorer Peter Hillary actually encountered a presence that manifested as the double of his dead mother.
Oh, yeah. The whole ancestor is appearing.
Yeah. Which is important to think of when we're thinking about the mountains as a potential place where one can encounter the spirits of the departed.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was reading around about this, I ran across a Scientific American article from 2010 on the sensed presence effect, and this was from Michael Shermer. Always a great source to turn to for discussions of paranormal experiences because he is an individual who has had paranormal experience.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was, if I'm remembering correctly, it was like a cycling marathon he was on.
Hmm.
It was, it was like a strenuous exercise, and then he ended up like seeing an alien. But it was because of like something he'd been watching previously. He's written about it. Quite a bit. But applying the skeptical mindset and then understanding how hallucinations occur, how we think about hallucinations after they occur, takes all of this into account. So he touched on all of this, and he pointed to four or so scientific explanations that he says really get to the heart of what's going on when people like this encounter some sort of spectral apparition or a third man, et cetera. First of all, isolation triggers the mind to hallucinate the normal feeling we get when we're working or traveling among other people,
mm-hmm.
Which seems to be a standard here. Then the rational cortical control over emotions shuts down due to oxygen deprivation, sleep deprivation, or exhaustion, and this opens the door for inner voices and imaginary companions. Next, he says our temporal lobe body schema, this is the brain's image of our body and what it's doing, is tricked into thinking you have a double.
Hmm.
And ever up for a game of rationalization and story making, the brain then constructs a plausible explanation for this double's presence.
Okay.
Like there's another person, there's another human being that's covered in furs, and they're next to me. Oh, well, I guess that is another mountain climber. Likewise, though, I could see where this would be exactly the kind of thing that could be misinterpreted as a Yeti, right?
Hmm.
Because if you're climbing a mountain in the Himalayas, you're probably bundled up head to toe. You probably don't look like a low-altitude human anymore. Then there's the mind schema. This is our psychological sense of self, and it's simply coordinating independent neural networks to solve the problem of survival in extreme situations, and the hallucination comes out of its function of making us feel like we're a single mind.
Ah, yeah.
But then, on the sleep deprivation situation, he points to Charles A. Lindbergh's transatlantic flight. And Shermer quotes his writings, quote, "The fuselage behind me becomes filled with ghostly presences, vaguely outlined forms, transparent, moving, riding, weightless with me in this plane, conversing and advising on my flight, discussing problems of my navigation, reassuring me, giving me messages of importance unattainable in ordinary life."
Hmm.
Shermer also shared that his own brother-in-law, a man by the name of Fred Zeil, experienced a sensed presence on both of his Everest climbs. The first case involved frostbite and a lack of oxygen, and the second entailed his collapse from dehydration and hypoxia. Quote, "Tellingly, when I ask his opinion as a medical doctor on possible hemispheric differences to account for such phenomena, Fred noted Both times the sense was on my right side, perhaps related to my being left-handed. The sense presence may be the left hemisphere interpreter's explanation for right hemisphere anomalies.
Oh, this takes us back to our split brain episodes.
Exactly.
The idea of the interpreter. Now, normally this would be the left hemisphere interpreter. This was Michael Gazzaniga's idea of the interpreter being this function in the brain that sort of ties together disparate neural phenomena into one experience that we sense as a single unified whole and sort of tells a story that makes it all part of the same game, where in fact, you know, the hemispheres, as was shown in the split brain experiments, can behave quite independently of one another.
Yeah.
But we've got this thing that Gazzaniga calls the interpreter that says, no, that's all you. It's just you.
So two things come to mind in discussing all of this. First of all, is anytime we discuss altitudes and pressure, I'm reminded of the fact that human beings are not a creature that evolved to thrive on the earth. They're a creature that evolved to thrive in a very thin atmospheric layer on the earth.
Oh, yeah.
And then only within certain ranges. And when we get out of those ranges, when we get out of our layer that we thrive in, we can run into problems. The other thing I'm reminded of is, Joe, have you ever been to a children's musical performance, preferably a band or an orchestra?
I've been in that performance. Yeah, I've been to one too.
So you know how ideally, if everybody's doing their job and the conductor's pulling it all together, there's a unity. You know, they're performing this piece.
Sometimes,
but in other cases, things kind of drift and fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's kind of what's being described here at high altitude, like the orchestral performance that is our mind state is drifting a little bit. It is like it's not so much a professional level performance anymore. It is a middle school band performance, and things are getting out of sync. Things are getting out of whack. And then what does that mean when we are the performance?
That's a really good analogy, because in that case, I mean, when you've got, even if Gazzaniga's interpreter theory is not exactly right, there clearly is a way in which the mind, the human brain is performing itself for an audience of itself. Like you, in a way, are the audience of what your brain is doing. Mm. And so you're there watching how the show is going. And if the show is not going right, you are sensing it, even though you are also the thing that's messing up.
All right. So I am not a mountain climber. I am not a mountaineer. I've visited mountains. I've had, I think I discussed like maybe a very limited reaction to an increase in altitude that was slightly noteworthy.
Mm-hmm.
But I know we have to have some mountaineers out there who are listening to these episodes, or our listeners, regular listeners to the podcast. So we would obviously love to hear about your experiences at high altitude. Have you ever experienced anything like what we're discussing here? Or have you never experienced it? Or perhaps you can just speak to the awe and majesty of the mountains. Perhaps you've visited some of the sacred mountains that we mentioned in the first episode, and you have a particular favorite you wanted to discuss. We'd love to hear from you. Another question I have is, so outside of Lord of the Rings, outside of Skeletor Snake Mountain in Masters of the Universe and the traveling mountain fortress of the Beast in Krull, are there evil mountains in mythologies and folklore that we neglected to mention? Because I was looking around for them, and I like I say, the mountains tend to be part of just a sacred ecosystem, a sacred geography, or they're home to various beings. But like this idea of there being like a Mount Doom, a place of evil, or a place that has been occupied solely by an evil force, I just didn't see as much of that. Like aside from a few mountain trolls and a few Krampuses here and there, and certainly a few things that could maybe be classified as monsters that are thriving amid other magical creatures and spirits at, say, Kunlun Mountain. What are some potential examples here?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm sure there must be mountains that are believed to be hell or something like that, a place of evil gods, and that are physical mountains on Earth. But I I don't think I came across any.
So bring us your monsters is what I'm saying. Yeah. Bring them unto us so that we might see them and consider them. In the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes. You'll find links out to social media. And hey, if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do is to rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. Rate, review, leave us some stars, leave us a nice comment. It really helps out the algorithm and helps spread the word about the show.
Totally. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly with feedback about this episode, or to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.